Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knocks podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you once again without my co-host Andy Bailey, as he continues to tend to his newborn son, Benjamin. We will then excuse him for as long as he needs to. This does mean that I am super pleased, though, to be joined by Cole Zuwicker. He is a co-founder and writer for The Stepien. He's a scout for At Net Scouts. He contributes to The Step Back. He is also an attorney and an MBA collective bargaining agreement expert. You should definitely be following him on Twitter. He is at Cole Zuwicker. That's C-O-L-E-Z-W-I-C-K-E-R. And definitely make sure you're giving him a follow. How are you doing? I'm happy to have you back, Cole.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Last time was fun. I think we rated the top prospects the last 3 years. And yeah, that was a lot of fun. I like this rapid fire kind of style that you guys do.
It was, we went, like, there were just rabbit holes. And we started talking about Joe Harris's free agency, I remember, at the end. So stuff got weird, and it was awesome.
Yeah, that's always fun when it kind of goes off the ledger and you start, you know, having to make improvisational choices on the podcast.
Right, so we love the off-the-cuff stuff, but when you're doing, we were doing so much trade deadline content that it, with all the rumors and all the news, it just seems so scheduled. So I'm really happy to get back to just like some more random stuff, and that means that we get to do a mailbag today, which you were kind enough to agree to hop on and do. So we have questions here that were in the mentions of the mailbag tweet we sent out. So if you're ready, I'm going to fire away at you and help you lead us into this great unknown.
Let's do it.
All right. This one comes from Tom Fischel. He is a regular mailbag questioner at Fischel _ Tom. This will probably be irrelevant because Tibbs, but should the Wolves start Tyus Jones over Jeff Teague is his first question. He has two, but let's start with his first one.
I mean, from what I've seen of Tyus, he's been really solid this year. I know the defensive RPM really high. So overall, a lot of Wolves fans have been making that claim just for, you know, Tyus's shooting and defense fitting in that starting lineup next to Butler, Wiggins, and having Teague as that scoring punch off the bench. But to answer the question, I do think it's kind of irrelevant because Tibbs is probably not going to do it when you invest, you know, $17 million or whatever they're paying Jeff Teague as a starter. That's pretty hard to demote somebody like that you're investing that kind of capital in.
And I'm with you, and with Tibbs, it's not necessarily a demotion as an F you, I'm just not going to play you. Because the Timberwolves bench has totaled the fewest minutes of any NBA team in the league by almost, it's like a 75-minute margin, an 80-minute margin, which is fairly substantial. And he doesn't turn to those guys. And I kind of get the argument for it. And that lineup when Tyus Jones plays with the starters instead of Jeff Teague, they're destroying opponents by, I just looked it up, it's 24.1 points per 100 possessions. That ranks third among 84 qualified lineups that have logged at least 100 minutes this season. It's like that. I get it, but at the same time, like, I mean, you said it. You gave Jeff Teague, I think it was 3 years and $57 million. So why are you going to start Tyus Jones? And there was even talk, remember, right after the trade deadline that they would have interest in signing Derrick Rose, and then he has officially cleared waivers. So it's tough for me to believe that Tibbs is that high on Tyus Jones that he would really start him over Jeff Teague if given the option. And the other thing there would be he doesn't like to rely on youth. So you're looking at Tyus Jones, who, again, has been playing well, but he's 21, and that just doesn't seem like a Tibbs thing to do.
Yeah, you've probably seen more of Tyus than I have this year. Do you think his play is for real? Like, is it indicative of the numbers that he's put up so far?
I think I do, and it's not like I don't think he's a better player necessarily than Jeff Teague, but like he shouldn't have to fight with Jamal Crawford for minutes in the backcourt. He most certainly shouldn't have to fight with Derrick Rose for minutes in the backcourt. He's a pretty good finisher around the rim, and I love his defense. It's just something that Jeff Teague isn't going to bring. He's like, when I watch Tyus Jones, he reminds me of just, like, has the bulldogged relentlessness is the only way I could put it, of Kyle Lowry. And like, that's really fun to watch, and he has active hands. He is third in steals per 36 minutes among every player who's logged at least 1,000 total minutes this year. I just think he gives you more of what you need when you're looking at the starting lineup with Jeff Teague or with Tyus Jones. The issue for me would be I think another coach would maybe do something different and stagger players' minutes in different forms, and maybe it's a matter of let's let Jeff Teague just run more of these second units, or let's experiment even more with just Jeff Teague and Andrew Wiggins on the floor, and we'll let Tyus Jones run with starters. But the two caveats I would say, and I'm interested to know whether you would agree, one, if he's playing a lot of second unit minutes, the competition's going to be inherently easier, and two, he's going to get to play with a lot of starters, so some of his numbers are going to be inflated defensively, too, because you get to play alongside Taj Gibson and Jimmy Butler. So that probably factors into it a little bit, but I just look at him, and he's probably more complimentary than Jeff Teague is, and so when you have someone who's willing to accept basically that role player role and thrive in it, that's where it becomes like almost an issue of fit over flash, even though Jeff Teague isn't some star. But that's what this really kind of seems like to me.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, Butler's their best initiator on offense by far on that team. You already have Towns as far as his regression usage wise. Like, he doesn't get the same looks he's already getting. So why wouldn't you want to put more fit players and more kind of role players in there that will just bring that 3-and-D element like Jones? Let Butler run your offense, get Towns more involved, and then let Teague kind of be that scoring presence off the bench. I totally get where the listener is getting with this question. I think it makes a lot of sense. It's just a factor of reality and, you know, real-time issues with franchises. Like, starting point guards, you make that much money. It's hard to put them on the bench and make them play that role. But I totally agree with you as far as finding out ways to better stagger lineups, getting Tyus with the starters more, getting Jeff Teague with the backup guys. You can still do that without just having to flip your roster or your depth chart over with who starts and who comes off the bench. It's all about maximizing lineups. Maybe, you know, pull Jeff Teague out a little bit earlier in the first quarter, enter him in with the second unit. That would just go a long way, I think, in kind of optimizing all of these guys.
I'm with you there. Moving on to the next part of Tom's question, do the Raptors have a legit shot at beating the new-look Cavs? I'm assuming he means in a seven-game playoff series.
I mean, a legit shot, I don't know what degree we're going out there. I think they have a reasonable shot. The Raptors, I mean, stylistically, they're a little bit different this year. But again, we have to factor in their recent playoff history. And the guys, Kyle Lowry's been great in the regular season. DeMar DeRozan's been great this year. If they regress again in the playoffs, it's just tough to beat a team with LeBron and spacing around him. I think the Cavs, I mean, everybody's talking them up after the Boston win. The Cavs are still going to have issues defensively. All their perimeter players have issues outside of, like, George Hill, who's a respectable defender. But Rodney Hood, Jordan Clarkson, J.R. Smith, those guys are all capable of being picked on. Can they really guard both Lowry and DeRozan? Maybe. I think they have a shot. I think the Raptors are definitely balanced. I could see them coming out of the East, but when LeBron has spacing around him, that's just going to be a tough out for any team to be able to guard them consistently as well. So I think offensively, the Cavs are still good enough. I would favor them in the East, but I do think the Raptors have a legit shot at beating them.
You touched on it with the LeBron plus spacing aspect of this, and it's something I kept coming back to. And when their trades initially went down, so this isn't including their win over the Celtics on Sunday, but the Cavs' outgoing players, the six of them, were shooting 29.1% combined on catch-and-shoot threes. Their four incoming players, 38.2% combined on catch-and-shoot threes. And they'd made almost 50 more threes combined than those six players that were going out. So to put that kind of shooting around LeBron James, I will have to wait and see if this works out long-term or for the rest of the season, but that's just so dangerous offensively. And I think you could have just made the case because the Cavaliers have LeBron James, they would remain the Eastern Conference favorites anyway had they not done anything at the trade deadline. That being said, the Raptors are just so deep. And this is, if I would have asked you at the beginning, or even just told you at the beginning of the year, that their defensive rating in the middle of February would rate higher than their offensive rating, would you believe me?
Probably not, no. From what I've seen of the Raptors, which I don't watch as much as a lot of people. I mean, I try to catch them, but they're kind of established, so I'm more focused on the young guys, but that would surprise me.
Yeah, they're third in defensive rating and fourth in offensive rating. Like, that's nutso balance, and they've just been getting great production off of basically everyone from their bench. They have so many. I think what makes them more dynamic against the Cavaliers this year, aside from DeMar DeRozan has basically perfected his craft in the pick and roll, he's shooting better than 34% from three this year, that certainly helps. But now you just have all these additive ball handlers, knowing you can get minutes from Dellen Wright, knowing you can get minutes from Fred VanVleet. That makes them a little scary. That being said, their defense has been so good, but like, they're not the they're not the switchiest team, even with OG Anunoby. I'm just not a fan of their front court combination, and Dwayne Casey does a hell of a job knowing and picking his spots and when to play Jonas Valanciunas. But Serge Ibaka has always been a little bit of an overrated defender. And what happens when the Cavaliers go super small? Like, can you get away with Pascal Siakam playing heavy minutes in that type of series? Or can you even get away with Poeltl, who doesn't really switch that much on defense anyway? I've underestimated the Raptors, I feel like, at every turn this season because they have just so many glue guys that are playing really well. But particularly when looking at Cleveland's new roster, I would almost be inclined to make them heavy favorites in the series. And at least this time, though, it doesn't have much to do with, oh, Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan need to prove that they can be efficient in the playoffs first.
Yeah, it just comes down to whether or not Toronto can guard the Cavs. Like you noted, when the Cavs go small, they're almost basically unguardable. Like Kevin Love at the five, they're going to play Jonas off the floor. They have to play Serge Ibaka against them. They can kind of experiment with different lineups. The Raptors can, and I think they can definitely score in the Cavs. But when you start getting into kind of like a gunpowder matchup with the Cavs, as far as, you know, high velocity offense and all of that, that's going to be tough. I mean, the Warriors can obviously do that because they have the offense and the defense. But when you just have the offense and you go against LeBron, I mean, he's going to usually be the favorite in those kinds of matchups. And I just think that the Cavs, they're harder to guard now. They have, you know, athleticism. They have Larry Nance playing the small ball five. They can do that along with Tristan Thompson. Both those guys can be like spread pick and roll dive men. And when you put that kind of floor spacing around LeBron, again, it's just very, very difficult to guard that over a 7-game series because the Cavs can just get supernova hot and there's just nothing you can really do about it. J.R. Smith and Jordan Clarkson being kind of the two X factor swing guys, like against Boston when they shot well, that's just a really tough situation. So a lot of Toronto's players, like you noted off the bench, have been playing great this year, but they're also young players. We'll see how they react in a playoff environment with more consistent roles. I think all of those guys are legit rotation guys, and I do like their depth. But a lot of those guys aren't really established in the playoffs. That's kind of a lazy argument. We'll just see how that translates.
The other thing that'll be interesting to see is how Dwayne Casey just changes his rotation, because we know most coaches tighten up their rotations in the postseason, and one of the Raptors' most effective lineups, and one of their most used, it's their third most used that I'm looking at now, is just the all-bench mob of Miles, Poeltl, Siakam, Van Fleet, and Dellen Wright, and they're destroying opponents right now by 32.8 points per 100 possessions when they're on the floor, and that's their third most used lineup. It's only 147 minutes, but that's nuts. So, but what happens when you're playing your starters heavy minutes, or, you know, and the Raptors' starting lineup is good. Having OG Anunoby there, it completely, even when he's hit his rookie wall, it's completely shifted their defensive identity, made them more balanced. But what kind of happens when you're not exploiting your depth as often as you're used to, because you need to, or at least in theory, have your most important guys on the floor at all times? And if I'm looking at a squad that is going to play a top-heavy rotation, I am, of course, going to pick the Cavaliers over the Raptors in that aspect.
And I think the last note for me is just the acquisition of OG. I'm not saying he can really guard LeBron consistently, and nobody really can, but they've never had somebody with his kind of physical traits in the playoffs. I mean, PJ Tucker last year, I guess you could say, but just OG's length and athleticism, they can have him in a high, you know, energy role guarding LeBron. He can exert full defensive energy on ball to, you know, just make LeBron's catches harder, make it harder for him to receive the ball. So there is some advantages to having him on the roster now. I mean, they don't, again, they haven't really had that kind of measurables guy that can really have that young kind of athleticism that can maybe give LeBron some hard time. I don't expect him to lock him down, of course, but just making his life difficult is a dynamic that would definitely be beneficial to the Raptors.
Yeah, for sure. And will he play a lot of four, maybe with Norman Powell on the floor in that series too? Because I just can't. I wouldn't be a fan of, you look at the Raptors front court, and Siakam's a good defender, but having even like one of those guys, one like him with Ibaka or him with Valanciunas or him with Poeltl, like none of those two-man combinations at the 4-5 really do it defensively for me when you're looking at a potential Raptors-Cavaliers series. That would just be, but again, having Anunoby's huge. And how about, I was actually right or talking about this the other day, one of the stroke of geniuses of Masai Ujiri was when they traded that first round pick to get Ibaka from the Magic, making it the less favorable of their own, and I think it was the Clippers, and that really put them in a position to draft Anunoby in the first place, which is just incredible when you look back. That's a nice little bit of just hindsight.
That's a great point. Yeah, Masai's so good. I mean, I think he's been so underrated as a GM. Oh, yes, he's been properly rated as one of the elite guys, but that was a great trade, and just protecting like that just shows that everything matters. Every single marginal choice you make, even choosing between the two picks. Nobody really expected OG to fall that far outside of like the medical information that came at the last minute, but still, I think they said they were shocked to see him at 23. I know the Nuggets traded down in hopes of landing him at 24. That's at least the story. So great get by them.
Yeah, and that was the other thing, is I was shocked that he even was available to start the season. Like, forget, like, hit, you know, Norm Powell goes down, he enters the starting lineup, never gives up the spot. I just never, I never even saw him beginning the season. If you had to pick, though, so right now there's a 7-game series between the Cavs and the Raptors. Would you give the Raptors 6 games? Not to win, but do you think they would be able to push Cleveland to 6 games?
Yeah, I would go between 5 and 6. I'd say Cavs in 5 or 6. Probably lean 6 right now. Just, again, I'm not feeling the Cavs defense yet. I mean, we'll see how that manifests over the next 27 games or whatnot. But yeah, I'd probably lean Cavs in 6.
It's amazing, and they defended well against the Celtics, the Cavaliers did on Sunday night, but it's one game. It's amazing, though, that this is where we're at. Even if we assume the Cavaliers' defense is terrible, we've all been getting these jokes off, we've all been criticizing them all year, and we're just at the point where the team that is number one in the Eastern Conference right now, I'm with you. I might even pick the Cavaliers in 5. It's just, it's all so futile, isn't it? You know, with the East is still, it seems at this point, oh, you have LeBron James, all right, we'll see you in the NBA Finals.
Pretty much. I mean, he deserves that too. I mean, over the years, like, he's shown, like, if you give him floor spacing, he's like the only guy I've ever seen that can handle pretty much all the playmaking usage, and he can get you to the finals.
Yes, so I'm with you. I'd probably pick 5 or 6. I might almost lean 5, but the Cavaliers' defense is iffy, and if it were to start today, there'd obviously maybe be chemistry issues. But 6 feet, the Raptors have been so good, so I'll say 6. I'll go with you on Cavs in 6. This question comes from Mario, at Mario Meridall. I'm probably mispronouncing that terribly. It's at Mario, Meridall. Want to speculate where Donovan Mitchell's development would be today had everyone from Utah's 2016-2017 season stayed?
Probably one of the most difficult questions to answer, just because predicting rate of development is probably the single hardest thing to do with prospects. So obviously court time is what he's getting at, and like that muscle memory, getting on the floor and getting that experience, as opposed to if he wasn't in the same role. I think you have to factor in you can't replace on court experience. So I don't think he's going to develop the same way as far as how they're using him as a high usage kind of creator type, as pick and roll passer. A lot of things he didn't really show at a high usage in college as far as getting to the rim, finishing. So I don't think he would develop the same way, because honestly, his role would probably be different if, you know, everybody, like, if Hayward's there and he's playing pick and roll, Mitchell's probably more of a spot up guy. He just came into a situation where Rodney Hood was injured to start the year, so Mitchell was placed in a more on ball role, and you just can't really replicate that in any other way. So I think, honestly, if this didn't happen the way it did, maybe you look at Mitchell as more of like an Avery Bradley type. That was a really consistent kind of player comparison I saw for him coming out. And he's obviously surpassed that. I mean, his ball handling has been much better. His playmaking for others has been better. And he's just been more of like a lead guard or hybrid lead guard, maybe more of a 2, but definitely more of a playmaker. And he's gotten that experience and that usage where a lot of rookies wouldn't have.
And the other thing I always wondered is, do they make that trade for Donovan Mitchell if they didn't have a strong inkling that they were going to part ways with George Hill over the summer? Maybe they would make it anyway. But if would that have been Gordon Hayward's situation with free agency, always would have been up in the air, and I don't think that they thought necessarily that he was going to leave at that point. George Hill's situation was always a bit more curious. I know they ended up trading for Ricky Rubio right before free agency started, so was that writing on the wall even earlier? Maybe you kind of saw that, well, if we're not going to have George Hill on this roster, we just need other ball handling options. And I question whether if you would have told me they have no idea what's going to happen with George Hill, or they think he's going to come back, would Mitchell have still been the guy that they go in for on draft day?
From all the reports that I've heard, yes. I mean, a couple of guys, beat writers for Utah, said that, you know, Mitchell blew them away in their personal workout. Like, he's even noted that on a podcast. He said that, you know, his workout in Utah was awesome. He was terrible in Miami, apparently. So that's kind of the way this goes sometimes, is who you play well for in these personal workouts goes a long way. But one of the beat writers for Utah said that they had him like number one on their board. Now, who's to know if that's really true? If they would have actually taken him at number one overall, like it's been reported, that's just mismanagement. I mean, you would at least try to trade back. That would be the responsible thing to do, trade back to like 6 or something for somebody who wants Fultz or Lonzo. But it sounds like from all reports that Mitchell was their guy, regardless of how they felt about Hill. I know there were other reports that said Hill kind of poisoned the waters with the franchise a little bit. They didn't part on the best of terms, so maybe that had some part to play. I think that's a good point to bring up, though, and it's hard to really know for sure. But from all reports and for all indications, it sounds like Mitchell was their guy kind of through and through.
He just never, and I agree with you, even if he was their guy, he never would have gotten this type of opportunity playing with. Again, if it was both Hayward and Hill, would he even play? Because look at how many ball handlers Utah's roster is then saddled with. I guess maybe he would see Quinn Snyder's always been kind of open to testing. I don't want to call him a fringe guy, but he's always been kind of open to testing different players in different lineups, especially when things get rough and the Jazz are notoriously injured, it seems, all the time. So maybe he would have experimented, but forget what his role would have been on the court. Would he even have seen it?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, that's huge for rookies. I mean, how you utilize and what your role is in a large part defines your progression. I mean, getting these reps and understanding, you know, passing angles. He's worked a lot with Ricky Rubio on this stuff, and these are huge qualities to him as a primary creator type. If he's going to emerge as that guy, or he's going to be more of a two guard, I think you can make a pretty definitive case that if he comes in behind Hayward and Hill, he's not developing these skills at the same rate, and he might, and his chances of becoming like this primary ball handler type would be mitigated.
And the one thing, so this would be, I guess, my own question I'm going to throw to you in the mailbag. Do you think that he has a legitimate chance of beating out Ben Simmons for Rookie of the Year?
I don't know. It just depends on how people view it. Like, the people that cover this kind of voting, it's more about like scoring and highlight plays, and Mitchell has that. Like, he's a better shooter than Simmons, and of course, from three and everything. And I think he pops more as a scorer. So I do give him a chance to win. I would clearly vote Simmons. I just think he's affected the game in so many different ways. Some that, you know, you don't see really being mentioned that much. Like, his defense has been a lot better than his reputation suggested, which was always kind of a false narrative when it came to his defense at LSU. Like, he didn't try, but it wasn't because of a lack of abilities or whatnot. So I guess to answer your question more succinctly, I think Mitchell probably has a chance to win just because of how people view this kind of award. But Simmons is my clear-cut top guy.
I'm wondering if it factors in. I think Simmons is still the top guy for me, but I just look at just what Donovan Mitchell's doing for a team that's contending for a playoff spot in the West and what he's done when some of the more important players aren't on the floor. Whereas with Simmons, the Sixers are still just awful, basically, whenever anyone plays without Joel Embiid. But again, Simmons' defensive tools, like, those have been super impressive. I would be remiss, however, if I didn't mention that I'm just, whenever Ricky Rubio has not been on the floor this season and Donovan Mitchell's gotten to run the show, it's been pretty interesting with some of the Jazz's most used players. And Andy likes to continue to come back to this. And with with Rubio off the court, when Mitchell plays with Ingles and Gobert, the Jazz are a plus 11.4 per 100 possessions with top-notch offensive and defensive ratings. That's just, I just think it's way closer than I ever would have thought. I think a month into the season, I was just, it's Ben Simmons, and no one's going to even come close to topping him.
Yeah, I am 100% with you. I did a podcast with Sam Vecenie about 3 weeks ago. We talked about, you know, top five rookies so far, and he was clear-cut Simmons one, and I was more like, I would start entertaining arguments for Donovan Mitchell in that stratosphere, even though I would still lean heavily to Simmons. Mitchell has an argument.
Next up is Brad Murdoch at Kelper Express, or Kepler Express, excuse me, at KEPLEREXPRESS. Out of the teams near the back, who drops out of the Western Conference playoffs before season's end?
Oh, boy. Let me see here. It's easy to say the Pelicans overall just because of the Boogie injury. Miritich is going to give them an added spacing dynamic, but it's just hard to see the depth on that roster really surviving. They're so heavily reliant on Anthony Davis. Like, I watched the Nets game the other day, and he was just absurd in that game. Double overtime. But it's just hard to rely on so few primary guys. Like, they were so top heavy as is, and then you regress to losing Cousins. Now your front court's a little bit decimated. You're relying so much on Davis and Drew Holiday. They seem like the clear-cut team to me. I mean, you can argue Portland as well. It's going to be tough just because, I mean, there's, what, two games separating six from eight right now? Mm-hmm. So you can see the Jazz are on a roll. They've been playing really well lately. So I could, it's tough. Within those couple teams, I think I trust the Nuggets the most. They're going to get Millsap back at a certain point. I know that's been kind of a rough acclimation with him and Jokic to an extent. But right now, the Pelicans are the clear choice for me of a team to regress.
I don't know that there is another pick. If the Nuggets, or not if, when they get Paul Millsap back, that's like kind of their trade deadline acquisition, so to speak, because you haven't had him. And then even with Trey Lyles' emergence, like those are kind of your two big-time additions to the roster. The Blazers, they're so up and down, I can't see them dropping off. And the top five for the West is just in for me. And I would be inclined to go just saying that it would – the playoff race is going to stay where it lies right now. But at the Clippers, I feel like they could be frisky. And the Jazz have been playing so well. They've won 9 in a row. They've been absolute monsters since Rudy Gobert came back. And for all the reasons you said, the Pelicans are just the easy choice. And I wonder how, if we look, so say the Pelicans miss the playoffs. And again, they only have a half game lead on the 8 seed right now. That being said, they're only 2 games off of 5th place. So we can't, this isn't a death knell. Would you view that trade for Mirotić any less favorably if they miss the playoffs now, or is it just, well, they got off Omer Asik's money, so it's fine?
For me, it's always an issue of process and not result. I mean, most of the time, I like to judge decisions based on what the input was. And you look at a team like the Pelicans, they haven't kept a single first-round pick since they drafted Anthony Davis. So they've either traded the pick or traded the player that they got. So Buddy Hield, I love that trade. That was the one exception for me. Buddy Hield for Boogie Cousins, I completely understood that move. But I just see a consistent error in how they evaluate and how they proceed as a franchise. Like, why you can't just keep, you know, throwing the towel in on your picks, and you have to invest in your future. Like, what if they kept those picks over the years with Davis and actually cultivated talent and built a roster around him? So I just don't like the decision every year to kind of trade that doesn't really move the needle. Like, okay, I get that you're a franchise, you want to, it's a business, you want to make the playoffs for that extra revenue. But there's no guarantee that you make the playoffs if you traded your first-round pick for Mirotić. And, you know, $12.5 million for Mirotić is fine next year. I think Mirotić is a solid player, but he doesn't move the needle for me. And this pick could be in this class, which is really loaded. I mean, it could be like the 12th pick in the class. That could be like Mikal Bridges, who's one of like the best 3-and-D wings in 5 years. So it's just tough to really gauge and respect the decision-making process every year, because it just doesn't – I don't know. I'm philosophically against what they do on a yearly basis.
It's amazing how often they've kind of done it too. It seems like ever since Anthony Davis's sophomore season, like was it maybe like the Tyreek Evans contract, like marked this shift in thinking that we just have to try and win all out as soon as possible. And it's led to just this series of impulsive decisions when you look at how the roster has changed over those years.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I don't know. I mean, the Solomon Hill, that off season where they just got those, it's just, yeah. I don't have much else to say about them.
Yeah, I will say this for them: they did not give out 2016 money in 2017 like the Knicks and the Bulls. That was one of the more funny things to me, giving 4 and 32 to Cristiano Felicio when I want to know who was giving him that money, and then the same for Knicks and Tim Hardaway Jr. at 4 years and 71. So the Pelicans can put that under their hat.
That's a fair point.
This is a kind of a fun one, kind of a tough one, from Tim Slim at me, Tim Sim, MeTimSim. If you started a franchise, what starting five would you choose? No cap for the next 7 years.
Okay, this is tough. I'm going to kind of go one guy and then pass it back to you, and we'll do it that way, because off the top of my head, this is difficult. I think I would go Giannis first.
He would be my first pick, and I think that's kind of a no-brainer. I would think.
Yeah, just building around him's a little bit different, because I'd like to play him more at center and kind of get just mismatchy like that. I think that's how you really extract him, is like the role man type. But he's the guy that stands out for me. Is there any guy after that's clear cut for you?
Is this going to be like too much of a cliche, or I would say Anthony Davis. I just feel, yeah. I mean, do we forget that he's not even 25 yet? He's going to turn 25 in March, and he's just so good. And that kind of ruins your play Giannis at center thing. But you could play Giannis at the 4 with him at the 5, and they're basically interchangeable. And Davis hasn't liked playing center in the past. So I mean, he's still, to me, when we talk about the next in line to take LeBron James's throne, I do believe it's Giannis Antetokounmpo, but I also feel like Davis is basically that next option up. And we tend to not, I'm not calling out individuals, but I feel like collectively in the NBA verse, we've almost forgotten about him or started to take him for granted.
I agree with that. And like, just from building a roster, I guess, conducive to Giannis, Davis makes a lot of sense with his jump shooting ability. He gives him a little more versatility instead of, you know, a guy like Ben Simmons, who I think is probably a top 6 or 7 prospect moving forward. His fit on that team gets a little dicey just because you have to kind of choose who's your guy that's, you know, going to be your non-shooter almost mm-hmm. and not have that gravity. So I think that I would lean Giannis there.
Do you have a second guy? Would it be Anthony Davis for you as well?
He's definitely in consideration. I'm looking over the teams right now, and he stands out probably more than everybody else. I mean, Towns, defensively, you have concerns there. I think I would take Davis. Embiid, that's the tough one for me because I love Embiid. I think that he would
be injuries, right?
Exactly. He'd probably be my number two prospect, even over Davis. Honestly, I think he can anchor a defense to a higher degree. His upside is higher there. But with the injuries, I think I'd probably give the slight edge to Davis there.
So who your second would be? So it is Davis then. I just want to make that clear.
Yes.
So we have Giannis and Davis. Who would you put as your third?
I think you have to go guard here, I guess, because you need some kind of off-the-dribble shooting dynamism there. It's tough because all the elite offensive guards right now are older. I mean, would you consider Steph Curry or James Harden in this conversation, even with their age?
I might consider Stephen Curry. I'm not going to lie. He's just so good off the ball, and I feel like his game is the type of game that should age well. But he's going to be – so in 7 years, he'll be 36. That's probably too – I probably wouldn't pick him. That's so tough. He turns 30 in March, so that's so tough. I probably wouldn't pick him, but I'd consider him. And James Harden's even younger. I think – what is James Harden, 27, or is he 28 now? James Harden is 28. So I would consider it, but I think I don't know. That's tough. Would you pick either of them?
Yeah, I mean, you start getting into conversations based on, like, prospects then, like, with Donovan Mitchell, or, like, you can't pick Markelle Fultz based on the situation. If you're talking about pure prospect and he was UW Fultz, I would think about him. But you got to start adding some off-the-dribble and off-ball shooting equity to this roster. So it comes down to how you feel about some of these young point guards, maybe some young wing types. And, again, a lot of the established players are older guys. And a lot of the younger guys are bigs, like Kristaps, Jokic. Those guys would be fine picks. Depends on how big you want to get. I mean, you could play Anthony Davis, Porzingis, and Giannis together in theory. Would you actually want to do that?
No. I think my pick for three, I think I would honestly go Donovan Mitchell. I feel like it's kind of a nice hedge, and he's already a good shot creator, and you put him, he can run pick and roll with both Giannis and Anthony Davis, and he also still gets to be the secondary ball handler at points because you have Giannis. And just, I like to look for guys who can play off other guys. And Giannis, I think he's been working as a role man, particularly this season, but he, like you said, if he's going to be your non-shooter, I'm going to want a young dynamic guard there. I would go Donovan Mitchell. I'm really tempted to take Stephen Curry, and I'm not entirely convinced I won't take him by the end of this exercise.
That's kind of where I'm leaning to, just going over these guys. I mean, you could make a case on this roster for fit. Jason Tatum would make a lot of sense. I mean, his off-ball shooting, you don't really need a lot of creation, even though I think he's probably capable a little bit more than he gets to show in Stevens' offense. Does he have the same kind of upside? A guy like some of the other wings, like Ingram, just haven't established themselves as much. So I think I'd probably go Stephen Curry with three just to make that a definitive pick.
Nice. I'm glad you went there. Who would you go with for four?
Oh boy, I think you got to add some wing at some point that has a little bit more size. Can we go Kawhi Leonard? Or like I don't know. Like with the injury concerns, I think I would lean him honestly. If things are in a vacuum and we know his health, I think I would pick Kawhi.
He spent his entire career in San Antonio too, so this could be like super precautious or something. And I'm with you. I think that would be a solid pick. Yeah, he's 26. I mean, he's not going to be incredibly old over the next 7 years. So I think that's a solid pick, and putting him in that line. I mean, your lineup now with Stephen Curry, AD, and Giannis. That's like, I feel, instant three titles in a row. I'd probably go Kawhi Leonard too, though. And that's not even a follow in your footsteps. Just he's like a defensive changer, a game changer on the perimeter. And so I think that's big time. And for five, at least for me, I don't know who it's going to be. I think I'd probably hedge with someone like more on the youthful side. But who would you pick to round out that starting five?
I'm leaning Mitchell. But again, like, how old is Paul George? Is he like 28, 29-ish already? Or he's got to be up there.
How old is Paul George? He is 27.
I might go Paul George. If we're talking about just adding a ton of off-ball shooting, defensive versatility. You put a lineup with Stephen Curry, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Giannis, and Anthony Davis on the floor. I think you accomplish playing both sides. You have a ton of switchability outside of Steph, but I think I'm going to go Paul George for my fifth guy.
I think I'm going to go Stephen Curry because I was so tempted to take him. It's funny that we only diverged on one player. I really wanted to think – I guess I didn't build the roster accordingly, but someone like a Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum, if you were really betting on the youth, they would have been interesting on one of these rosters.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of what the question was going at a little bit more than how we approached it with the hybrid kind of youthful guys. Like Paul George isn't young, but he's still young enough. Same with Kawhi Leonard. Those guys are more established. I'm guessing the question was geared more towards – you know, taking the young prospects and who's the best out of that and building a team around those guys. But off the top of my head and off the top of your head, I think that's pretty well done job there.
Yeah, if I was going to go strictly youth, I would take out Leonard and Curry, and I'd probably put in Brandon Ingram and Jason Tatum. I think you know how high I am on Brandon Ingram.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely. I kind of share most of your sentiments there.
Do you, and this brings another, I guess, unrelated question, but who are you higher on long-term, Tatum or Jaylen Brown? That's a fascinating question to me.
I think Tatum, honestly, he's been better than I thought he would be defensively for sure. And the shooting, I just trust his shot-making ability more. And if he's going to bring plus defense, I don't necessarily see either one as being like Kawhi Leonard defensively. I don't think Jaylen's going to get to that level. I think there's still too many mental lapses. Physically and athletically, he's ridiculous. But I'm not sure if it's ever going to translate to the highest levels that people think. And I just trust Tatum's shot more. But it is a fascinating conversation. A lot of people see more self-creation equity with Jaylen Brown. And I think what's made him who he is how they've kind of utilized him and optimized him as kind of like a corner three-point shooter. He can really attack closeouts, gets to the rim off one dribble, can explode. And just more is less is more with him overall. I think that was the problem with him in college. You saw a lot of self-creation situations where he would turn the ball over. He didn't have great spacing, of course, but I'm not sure if the decision making for him is ever going to be there. I kind of trust Tatum in all of those respects a little bit more.
I've gone back and forth, and I think my pick for a while has been Jaylen Brown, and it was primarily for the reason that I just see more self-creation out of him. But if you have to kind of project, Tatum's eventually going to be there. He's taken some tough pull-ups this year. They're not necessarily falling, but he does look like he could be that guy. And he probably looks long-term like he would be the better passer. Jaylen Brown gets like this tunnel vision when he's in the post or when he's on drives. And it's still really close for me. And maybe I think you're right. That was a good way to put it. It probably won't translate at the highest levels, that difference. But for me, it's just so damn close. And I feel like I vacillated a bunch. I think I have no idea. I've been picking Jaylen Brown, but Jason Tatum over the past, even as his shooting has kind of waned, it's his defense has really just won me over probably like the last month or so.
And that's really it for me too. Like following the draft, not a lot of guys predicted that he would be this kind of defender this quickly. It just didn't manifest at Duke for whatever reason, whether he was recovering from injury or he just wasn't put in positions to really show his intelligence. And that's kind of my biggest takeaway with Tatum is just he's a smart player on both sides. Like he knows how to move without the ball offensively and defensively. They utilize heavy switching schemes, which helps him maybe not blow weak side rotations and whatnot, but he's been a lot better there effort-wise. Athletically, I think that's translated better than he got credit for as well. So he just does a little bit more for me offensively and defense. I don't really see the difference being that considerable to where I would just lean Tatum shooting. I think that's more of a surefire bet. And like you know, Jaylen Brown's decision making has never really been there. I think he's good in the role he's in. It would be kind of fascinating to see what would happen with his future if he went to another team. I'm not giving Boston all the credit. I think they deserve some. Jaylen deserves some as well. It's just kind of a player that was more of an athletic mold guy coming out. You could kind of, you know, shape him any way you want. And the Celtics have done an awesome job, and his work ethic and personality and all that stuff has really shined through.
It seems like Jason Tatum would be the easier plug-and-play option. And the other thing I probably should have realized, because we all know, like, the measurements. Jason Tatum has a 7-foot wingspan. Just watching him defensively sometimes, the way his arms react in passing lanes or when he's even in space, I guess I never fully appreciated how long he actually was.
Yeah, no, it is. Absolutely. I think that's a really good point.
This one, I guess we should transition right to it. This is Raptors versus Celtics in the 7-game series. Who you got? That's from Dharma Nike, at Mind of Dharma, MindOfDharma. I apologize if I butchered the pronunciation. But as we know, if you listen to this, I suck at pronunciations.
That's a really great question. I have not watched these two teams match up this year, honestly. So it's tough to really put a ton of stock in this. I think I might lean Raptors right now just from what I've seen out of Boston, I mean, I trust their defense to an extent. Offensively, I think they might be a little bit too lenient on Kyrie Irving and, you know, Horford creating from the high post. Can they really guard Toronto, and can they score at a high enough level? I know their offense is dropping off a little bit of a cliff of lately, from what I've seen at least. So I might lean the Raptors slightly, but that's kind of a coin toss to me, as you can see by my hesitation.
I would lean Raptors too. I was actually hoping that would come off hot takey, but now it won't because you already said it. Boston, to me, I was, insofar as I could be disappointed in a team I don't care about, I was disappointed that they didn't go out and get kind of another self-sufficient scorer at the trade deadline, especially when it seemed like those opportunities were there. I thought they definitely should have, and maybe they did, but I thought they definitely should have kicked the tires on Rodney Hood, who instantly becomes your second best pull-up shooter behind Kyrie Irving. Even looking at the numbers, they don't have that guy in crunch time who can alleviate the burden on Irving in the half court when defenses are going to tamp down. And on a more macro level, they're statistically very good when Horford plays without Kyrie Irving. But part of the benefit of having those two players is you want to play them together. You don't want to have to worry about staggering as much. And so having that third shot creator in there, one day maybe it is Jason Tatum. It probably will be. Maybe it's even Jaylen Brown and you have four. Maybe it's even Terry Rozier. Those guys all bring a little bit of it right now, but just not enough for me to pick them in a series with the Raptors who are more balanced. The Celtics' defense is fantastic, and there are nights where their offense looks just electric, but they are 29th in points scored per 100 possessions since Christmas. 29th. That's ahead of just the Phoenix Suns. Like, that's just...
Yeah.
That's a red flag, and it's going to get harder to score in the playoffs. It can't be all Kyrie, and as you said, it can't be all Horford. And if they could have gotten Rodney Hood, or if that trade for Tyreke Evans would have went through, I would feel a lot differently. But not having that bona fide, just, I call it a second, because you're not even going to go to Horford when you need a shot down the stretch. Like, he's a fantastic passer, and I love him. He's perennially underrated. But, like, you need that second face up, top of the key, go get me a bucket, and they just don't have that right now. Jason, and they shouldn't. You know, Jaylen Brown's a sophomore, Jason Tatum's a rookie, and they're good for where they are now, but they just don't have that guy who's really going to help their offense out when the game matters most.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I didn't know they were that bad defensively since Christmas, or offensively, sorry. But yeah, the games that I've seen that they've struggled in is when Kyrie struggles, when teams can really get into him, make him, you know, force him into bad decisions and really take away him as an option, or at least mitigate him. They just don't have enough ancillary pieces. I love their system offensively. It involves everybody, motion type. They get the ball moving. You know, it's mostly predominantly Kyrie, Horford pick and roll, but they do have good system traits. Like, they headhunt mismatches with Jaylen and Tatum, especially when they play both of those guys in bigger lineups. They can, you know, they can create points that way, and Stevens is smart enough to siphon off points. But in the playoffs, like you noted, when the pace slows down a little bit, when teams actually start exerting more defensive energy and game plan to stop Kyrie, take those things away, do they really have ancillary scoring? Of course, with Hayward, they would have that piece. I mean, Hayward's a brilliant piece to put next to Kyrie. That makes a lot of sense. I think Tatum will get there, but it's kind of difficult to expect that from a rookie in the playoffs. I mean, Tatum's still 19, so I agree. I think in the playoffs, they don't have quite the offensive firepower in certain matchups to really get it done. And it's going to come down to Kyrie and how great he is in that kind of series. I mean, if Kyrie's playing at peak level Kyrie, when we've seen him be one of the five, you know, top three best offensive players in a series, they can definitely beat the Raptors. It's just the secondary firepower offensively isn't there.
I would probably go, I think that would be a great series, and I hope we get it. Seven game series, but I would pick the Raptors in seven for that one. Who do you think is a better, more threatening matchup for the Cavaliers, though, the Raptors or the Celtics?
That's another great question. I would say the team that could best give LeBron issues, but also be able to guard them better in space. So despite the fact that Boston just got whacked by them, I mean, Marcus Smart was not playing that game, and he's kind of big for their team defense. So that's something to take into account. That's really tough, man. These three teams are like splitting hairs, but I think I might lean Toronto's a little bit tougher. For the Cavs, just again for that offensive firepower, if the games translate like they have during the regular season to the playoffs. And in this series, Raptors-Celtics, I would probably do the same as you. Sorry to keep agreeing, but I mean, coin flip freaking series, I'm going to take Raptors 7.
No, and I'm with you there too. I want to, for the Cavaliers specifically, I'd almost want to say the Celtics, just because, as you said, giving LeBron James problem, they're just problems. There's so many different matchups that the Celtics can use there that the Raptors just can't. but they're far more balanced on the offensive end. If you need a team to kind of get in a shootout with LeBron and crew, I'd probably take the Raptors over them at this point. So there's the fan base, or the people still in the Toronto fan base who want us to care about their team and claiming that they forget. You heard it here. We think that the Raptors are a more threatening matchup for the Cavaliers in the playoffs. This one's from Christopher Banks, and I don't mean to laugh. At Panthers fan 2134, spelled exactly like it sounds. Think Oklahoma City will kick the tires on signing Derrick Rose?
Oh God, will they? I have no idea. I mean, I have no idea what his reputation is in the league. I can't begin to understand, with all the analytics departments that we have now with every team, that he would be highly regarded as just a name value type guy. Who's their backup point guard currently?
Raymond Felton.
Yeah, I would almost prefer Felton, honestly. Like, it's just he gives you an added shooting bonus. I don't really see any point in having Rose when Westbrook's going to play, you know, 38, 40 minutes in the playoffs, maybe more, and you're not going to play those two guys together. So I maybe he gets you down the stretch of the regular season, and you can rest a little bit more guys. That would be his real only value to me.
I couldn't even imagine them. Another ball dominant guy, and you have Paul George and Melo and Russell Westbrook on the roster, and you've already, your defense has been impeded because you lost Andre Robertson, and now you're going to add Derrick Rose into the fold. You also know that Derrick Rose and Carmelo Anthony do not work together, so kind of running them in second units would be a disaster. I would rather have Raymond Felton, and it's not even close. I don't know necessarily how teams view Derrick Rose around the league, but the Jazz, the Cavs traded him, the Jazz waived him. He was making the minimum. Like, it's just the Bulls couldn't wait to get rid of him. So I would imagine his reputation isn't all that great.
You would think, but go ahead.
But do you think he's going to – the teams I've seen for him, I think, are Washington, but Washington also has interest in Ty Lawson at the moment, per Woj, and then the Timberwolves. Do you think he goes to – he's going to – like, some people have even entertained the idea that he might be just out of the NBA now. I don't even know where I fall. There's still part of me that just feels like he's going to end up in Minnesota because of Tibbs, but I honestly don't know – where else he would fit. Washington would make sense, but Derrick Rose is basically a lower end Trey Burke at this point, and Washington tried out Trey Burke last year.
Yeah, I think from a sensical standpoint, I tend to side with that party of he might not be an NBA player anymore. I know Zach Lowe said that, and I tend to agree with that for the most part, but based on name value and familiarity, I could see him going with Tibbs. It would just kind of be a shame with how well Tyus has played this year, but it's definitely it's one of those moves you could definitely see transpire.
We should just put him on the Celtics just to test out Brad Stevens' acumen. Like, work your magic and make Derrick Rose an NBA player again. On the flip side, I'd rather have Shane Larkin at this point on that Celtics team than Derrick Rose. This next question comes from Danny Barlavi at DBARLAVI. Who should the Knicks target if they have the cap they want to have in 2019? So I just want to throw this out there, and I'm sure you know this. The Knicks, as of right now, are not projected to have cap space in 2019. If you bake in a max extension for Kristaps Porzingis and he gets $27 million, which is 25% of the projected $108 million cap, which if it continues going the way it has, it probably won't even be a $108 million cap. You'll have Tim Hardaway Jr. on the books. You'll be in the final year of Joakim Noah's deal. Maybe if you get rid of Lance Thomas's non-guarantee, I think he has a million guaranteed. So there you can kind of pencil yourself in for about $11 to $12 million in cap space. The only way you're really getting more, and that's if you don't – Emmanuel Mudiay, by the way, is going to be a restricted free agent in 2019 as well. So if you like him, he's going to cost you money with his cap hold. So they would have even less than $12 million in space when accounting for his cap hold. I don't know who I would say for them to target. If they're going to stretch Joakim Noah, which would be so Knicks, I think at this point you write it out because you know, to me at least, you know Porzingis is going to miss time next season as well. So you're essentially not competing for anything special for the next 2 years. Why have what would amount to, if you stretch him this summer, $7.6 million per year left on your books in dead money. So knowing that, though, if the Knicks were going to have cap space in 2019 or they can get to max room, which presumably they can, it just, I think there are too many unnecessarily hurdles involved. Who would you want to see them target?
It's really interesting. I mean, some of the top guys that could actually move, Klay Thompson, we know the situation with the Warriors and their cap sheet as far as luxury tax payments, and maybe those guys don't want to play with each other anymore at that stage. It's like, we'll go our separate ways, kind of like what Kyrie did with LeBron. Like, I want to see what I can do by myself. I'm not sure if like a 28-year-old, 30-year-old Klay Thompson is going to be the best building block next to Porzingis. And kind of the way I view that is I like to go all in on the same kind of general sphere of players. So when you're talking about, you know, if your core is, you know, 20 to 22, 23, I'd like to align players with that core free agency wise. It's just tough. I mean, realistically, I don't think they should pursue free agency because you're not going to get value.
I don't think
you're the Knicks. Yeah. So I would, like, you talk about like the draft this year, if they add like a Mikal Bridges and you see what you have in Neal Akeen as a point guard, I don't base really any decision making around Emmanuel Mudiay at this point. I mean, he's been such a disaster as a player. Maybe he gets new life in New York, but I'm not basing decisions around him. So I would build through the draft. I mean, for the first time, the Knicks have had their own picks and they haven't screwed it up. And, you know, Neal Akeen, I think, is going to be a solid player. Porzingis obviously was a great pick. You know, if they do well in the next two drafts, just kind of build through that core. You're probably not going to find a guy that aligns with him in free agency unless it's like a second round pick who outperforms their current contract. Hey, Jordan Bell is a good one as a realistic fit. I like Jordan Bell next to Porzingis. I think he can defend on the perimeter a little bit. So in 2 years, I'll go with him because he actually kind of aligns with the core a little bit.
Yeah, and so just doing some quick math here, if you remove Emmanuel Mudiay from the books and you go with Lance Thomas's non-guarantee and you pencil in Porzingis for $27 million and you go with, I'm just estimating on roster charges, it's crazy that a roster charge in 2019, by the way, might actually cost teams $1 million by that point. I think it's going to be almost $900K this year. They could get to rather easily, while keeping No One Hardaway on the books, about $17.9 million in room, maybe 18. That's rough, so they could obviously go up from there. I'm with you. It shouldn't be about free agency for them at this point. I do think Klay Thompson would be a great fit, but what are you competing for at this point? No, he doesn't align with Porzingis' window, but at the same time, Tim Hardaway Jr. and Courtney Lee could still be on the books. It's so tough to answer that question because I don't trust the Knicks not to make another like high-cost expenditure before then, like adding money via trade or something. If you're adding money and you're getting picks and prospects back, like, that's fine too, but they could talk themselves into just being, oh, we're this one player away, so we're going to make that trade. I don't want to say Kristaps Porzingis' injury was almost a blessing in disguise because they probably wouldn't have gone all in on a Kemba Walker trade, but as soon as that rumor hit, I was like, the Knicks are going to trade like Neal Akeen and their first for Kemba Walker in a heartbeat. You could just see it coming. I like Jordan Bell. He would be super interesting there. It's kind of just tough to like survey the free agency landscape at that point. I don't necessarily know who would be available. We know the big wings like Jimmy Butler is a player option. Kawhi Leonard, you know, if he would be willing to leave San Antonio, yes, he'd be on the older end at that point, but I would still go after him. The Jordan Bell one is super interesting. I don't know how much you want to invest in a big when you already have Porzingis, and I guess Bell can play some power forward, but Porzingis at some point probably needs to play predominantly center, definitely after this injury. I don't know. I guess that'd be – I like the Bell one. That's interesting. And if I was going to pick from the older brigade that we just named – I would probably say Klay Thompson because he would seem to be the most gettable. Just, I know we had the report like Leonard and Spurs weren't on the same page from ESPN.com, but that's just like whatever. Maybe Butler's gettable, but think about all the minutes he'll have on his legs after he'll have spent that much time playing for Tibbs. So that would be kind of where I'm at for them. They would have to see. I'm like trying to think of like what the like restricted free agency market would be that year. Maybe would it be a bad idea for them to kind of be that team that tries to overpay Kelly Oubre Jr.? He's really progressed, and he might be a really nice fit on that roster. But that's probably the situation they're looking at. If you have cap space, go after the restricted free agents who kind of align with your timeline. And I love Kelly Oubre Jr.
Me too. I'm a big. That's a nice call there. D'Angelo Russell's another guy. I mean, you're probably not going to outspend the Nets just because they'll outbid probably anybody for him if he shows to be the kind of player and prospect we thought coming into. But if you don't think that Neal Akeen is the point guard of the future, if you think of him more as a wing type or a secondary creator, which is I'm more in line with, then maybe you look at a guy like D'Angelo who can come and give you more shot making off the dribble, and he aligns with your core really well. But again, I don't think that's really realistic to assume they're going to be able to, I mean, if they max him and he's good, which is the only reason you max him for, the Nets will just match.
Yeah, and I mean, it's tough with restricted free agents because there are other, like Karl Anthony Towns, he'll probably get his extension, though. Miles Turner would be interesting next to KP. The Pacers would probably pay him to keep him. Malcolm Brogdon would be, he's long, and him and Neal Akeen together in the backcourt, if you're out on Mudiay, that would make for kind of an interesting combination. And the Bucks by that point, they're going to need to pay Eric Bledsoe and Chris Middleton are both free agents in 2019, and they'll presumably have just paid Jabari Parker. Will he still be in their plans? That might be another name for the Knicks to keep an eye on.
Totally agree. And like other guys, like, you know, like Devin Booker is going to get that max extension. So a lot of these guys won't be on the market, and we'll see like the overall market dynamics this summer with how much free agency is probably going to be suppressed based mostly on what happened in 2016.
Yeah. So it's tough to project, but I think, that would be the play that they should make, is maybe you find the younger restricted free agent and you make, you know, you don't want that restricted free agent to be Tim Hardaway Jr., but you find the right guy and you try and overpay him or make an aggressive offer that makes his incumbent team really think. And if you miss out, hey, at least you tried, and you can kind of, you know, 2020 will be way more interesting for them if you care about free agency should they decide to ride out the Joakim Noah contract.
100%.
And this would be our final question. It is also what I consider the toughest question, from Brian Ayers at @what_A_BA. The top of the draft is usually /best done via best player available. Which lottery teams do y'all see as best fits for the top eight or so prospects in this year's draft?
Yeah, this is what I think about a lot, unfortunately. So, I think you got to start with Luka Doncic. He's number one on my board. What is the best team fit for him? I think if Budenholzer stays in Atlanta, that's a really intriguing fit, honestly, just because they need a primary creator so much. He kind of can play off ball. He's a really good cutter, smart as far as relocating, all of that stuff. So he can initiate your offense and also play within a motion type scheme. So for me, I think Atlanta stands out a little bit more than some of these other guys, even though if the Cavs somehow get the top three pick, I would love to see Luka play next to LeBron. I think be so fascinating.
That would be, wow. I keep forgetting about the Nets pick and how close everyone is in like the bottom of the standings. You look at it, and as we're talking right now, the Nets they're tied in the loss column for the Kings have the lowest winning percentage. So they're tied in the loss column with the Kings with 38 losses. They're only a game back of the worst record in the NBA, or the lowest winning percentage, however you want to do it. That pick could end up, again, the teams behind them or in front, I don't even know how you phrase it, but the Grizzlies and the Magic and the Suns and the Mavericks and the Hawks and the Kings, they're all not trying to win either. And now you have the Knicks and the Bulls, and the Hornets at some point have to turn things down. But Luka Doncic in Cleveland would be something, although if LeBron comes back, I fully expect Cleveland to kind of trade that pick. I like Luka Doncic in Atlanta. My question, though, is I've seen a lot of mock drafts just have DeAndre Ayton going to Atlanta if they have the number one pick. Is that just because DA has become the unquestioned number one prospect in this draft, or does he make a ton of sense next to John Collins? Is Collins not a long-term center? I thought he'd be interesting. I know he's a little bit undersized, but I thought he'd be interesting as a long-term five.
Yeah, I think Ayton is just catching on. It's probably the likely number one pick. I think a lot of sites are split between Luka and Ayton. I think those are the two top guys for a lot of people, not for me personally, but you can see the appeal with the league as far as a guy with just ridiculous physical traits, all of the athleticism and kind of coordination baseline with the skill level that he has at his size. He's just kind of what most expect to be the number one pick most years, is a guy that has those kinds of tools. As far as on Atlanta, I've been impressed with John Collins this year. I wasn't super high on him coming into the draft, and he's impressed me. I'm not sure if he's good enough where I like to say you draft around. So he's definitely a piece for them, but I'm not sure if he's that kind of impactful piece where they would choose to pass up on an Ayton, even if they play the same position. He's just not that established yet. I do like him long-term as a small ball five, but at the same time, I'm not taking Ayton. If I viewed Ayton as the solid overall number one pick in this class and Atlanta landed at number one, John Collins is not making me pass up on DeAndre Ayton.
That's fair. I think I would agree with Doncic for you for Atlanta, and I've watched far less college basketball than you have, so people could probably just ignore whatever I say for the next 10 seconds. But they don't have the wing like creator right now. And they need a secondary playmaker overall, and it's not – or the second primary playmaker, as stupid as that sounds. It's not Kent Bazemore. Torian Prince has been kind of interesting running pick and rolls, and you can see that they'll even have DeAndre Bembry when he's been on the court try to do that. But Doncic is the guy that can actually do that. And since you have basically all your other wings, even if Bazemore's there and you have Prince, those are all complementary guys. So that just works with Doncic, and even if you still have Schroeder at the one. So I've just been personally surprised that Ayton has been – a lot of the mock drafts I've seen since Atlanta's basically been at number one for a lot of them for much of this year, that they've just had them with Ayton, but I guess that speaks to his stock more so than it does necessarily fit. But I think Doncic would be best suited in Atlanta for sure. I just don't want to see him go to the Kings, please. That's just what I'm holding out hope against.
Yeah, me too. I just did a to plug another podcast. I did a mock draft with Sam Vecenie yesterday in his Game Theory podcast. I had the number one pick, and I was the Kings, and I still took Luka, but that's definitely the destination I don't want him to go to, even though I think De'Aaron Fox has been a little bit better than the numbers suggest this year. This is not a situation that I'm fully encouraging anybody to go to right now.
There's also kind of like, I guess there's not a glut of wings, but like the Buddy Hield and Bogdan Bogdanovic and then having Doncic in there, that just gets confusing, and I don't know if the Kings are a team you can trust to juggle all of those odds and ends.
Yeah, I agree.
Who's your number two prospect? This is fun because I like that you've already deviated from what most mock drafts have as their top prospect.
Right now, I have Trae Young there, which is kind of a deviation from, I think, consensus. He's around 5, 6, 7. My 2 to 5 is pretty close quartered. Right now I have DeAndre Ayton, Michael Porter, Jaren Jackson, and Trae Young in that 2 to 5 range, and I have them even. But I would prefer, if I was forced to choose, I would prefer Trae Young and Jaren Jackson. For Trae Young, best fit right now, that's just really tough. I mean, Orlando's the obvious fit. They need him. Do I want him to go there is another question. So that's kind of they have the clearest need for him at the top of the draft. I mean, you can make a case for him next to Booker, but I think that caps your defensive ceiling the same way that Portland's is with Dame and CJ. It's just tough to really build a roster that way. So as far as offensive fit, I love it. I think Trae Young is an awesome offensive player. Lead guard type. Just out of the top, not a lot of teams really make sense. I'd love him next to Ntilikina in New York, but at 9, he's not going to fall that far. So I guess to answer the question, I would go Orlando just based on team need, even though I don't want to see it happen.
I agree with everything you said there, and Trae Young's probably the prospect I know the most about just because he's been he's the one that's taken everyone by storm, it seems. And watching him shoot is just, it's incredible to me and how quick he does things. Wouldn't this be, this would be, I don't know, I don't think that they would do it, and it definitely doesn't fill their biggest need, but Trae Young and Mike Conley in the backcourt would be something in Memphis.
I dig that, actually. That'd be really fun.
They need a wing badly, so I don't know that they would do that, but depending on where they land, if Trae Young is still there and some of those top wings are off the board, maybe. So I think it has to be Orlando. For Trae Young, though, just looking, like you said, at team need, not even necessarily fit, because Orlando hasn't shown that it can necessarily develop guys. Their post-Dwight Howard draft history or just rebuilding history has not been great. I would be more intrigued to see him in Phoenix, but it's like you said, that defensive ceiling is probably capped even lower than what Portland's is with McCollum and Lillard, because you've at least seen in Portland's conservative scheme, they've been okay with those two in the backcourt this year, but you're not getting a lot of size in Trae Young at all. And Devin Booker he's probably worse than CJ McCollum on that end of the floor. And I don't think that Trae Young will necessarily be as good as defense as Damian Lillard's been this season, but that's just so far off projections. I would be more intrigued to see what happens in Phoenix, but I agree that best fit is probably Orlando just by default.
Yeah, that's basically where I'm at.
And who's number three for you?
Jaren Jackson Jr. out of Michigan State. A lot of guys have him kind of categorized already as this role player type. I think there's more upside there. He's the best defensive player in the draft. He's better than Bamba. His instincts, his reactionary athleticism, all of that. I've never seen a defensive player like him for a big in college. I'm assuming, I didn't watch Anthony Davis that closely as a prospect. I just started covering the draft probably last year full time. I would assume it looked like Anthony Davis on that end. I mean, he's not Anthony Davis offensively. His ability to shoot off movement, off the dribble like Davis does, he just doesn't have the form for that. It's more of like kind of a pseudo push shot. But this is a guy who has high-level instincts. He's improved every year. He's one of the youngest players in the draft. Ridiculous rim protector, two-level defender who can play on the perimeter. So as far as team fit goes, he would be awesome on the Bulls next to Markkanen. I think that would allow them to invert their offense a lot. I mean, they get to have two floor spacing bigs, and Jackson can really cover for Markkanen's defense, even though Markkanen's been more solid than I thought he would for sure athletically defending on the perimeter. He's still not a rim protector. So adding Jackson next to him, I mean, right now the Bulls are 8, so they're much lower than what I would have Jaren, but it's conceivable that he falls that far. So the Bulls kind of stand out for me as far as roster fit. I like Hoiberg. I think he's underrated in several respects, so I think he'll be able to utilize Jaren. He's shown some proclivity to shoot off down screens, setting his feet quickly. So I really like that Bulls fit for him.
The Bulls fit is good, and what would you think, though, and they're probably a little bit too. I don't know. I mean, the odds are so close right now, and just looking at the records. But what did you think about him in Dallas?
I like that too. I mean, you can see a pick and roll kind of centric offense being based around Dennis Smith and Jaren Jackson, with Jackson's ability to pick and pop, open the lane up for Smith. I think honestly, Jackson fits anywhere. He's one of the easiest players to fit. His archetype is just insanely valuable if he can shoot threes. I mean, because he's going to be a high level rim protector. I think he could be the best defensive player in the league one day. I think he has those kind of consistent abilities. He's so high energy. He finishes plays. So you even talked me into a team like, I mean, if the Cavs, if they got him, I think he could help LeBron from year one as far as being like a Miami kind of Chris Bosh type, who's a better rim protector. Ooh. So I think there's a lot of different fits on here. Like, he'd make a ton of sense for Orlando too. They need floor spacing from the five. You could play him next to Isaac, next to Gordon. If they resign Gordon, he just really, you can go down the board and really, he makes a lot of sense for all of these teams.
Who is your number four guy?
Right now it's Michael Porter. But really tied with Ayton, both of those guys. But I'll go with Porter first because he's at least talked about. He's another guy who fits pretty seamlessly in the modern game. I think he's the best off the dribble shooter at his size in the draft. I've seen a lot of him because he played high school ball about 15 minutes from my house. So his senior year, I mean, he took the team that was, I think, last in the conference to number one in the entire country. So he's a real dude. I mean, Brandon Roy was the coach, and that was a great team. But as far as his fit, I mean, he's kind of reminds me, we don't know his floor game too much because he obviously hasn't played college basketball, so all the instincts, the defensive ability, it looks solid. Not sold on that yet, but as a shot making type who can play the four full time, like at 6'10", I think that he's kind of like a 6'10" version of maybe Paul George. So you can really fit that into so many different lineups. Right now, I mean, I think the Mavericks would be kind of fascinating. I think maybe if you did a pick and roll with Porter and Smith, teams would just switch that, but I think that would be a matchup causer and creator. I mean, they would definitely cause mismatches with that kind of lineup. That's how their lineup is structured. That's what Tankathon has right now as their number three pick. But again, I see his fit on so many of these teams. I mean, you could even argue Phoenix. They definitely need another scoring type. You know, Bender's not going to be that guy. Chris doesn't look like that guy. Next to Booker, they just have to have more of a secondary punch. So even the Suns would make a lot of sense for Porter.
I also kind of like him. Dallas would be super interesting. I'm trying to remember when they've had, when's the last time they had like an elite wing? And maybe I'm blanking on it and probably disrespecting someone. It's not Harrison Barnes, so let's just get that out of the way. Memphis would be interesting to me too. I don't know if that's just because I feel like the stuff he does is basically the player they've been on the lookout for since they were onto the map, and they've just been unable to find him. They thought that Chandler Parsons was never going to provide that same sort of athletic punch, but you plug Michael Porter in there, would they be progressive enough to use him as a four? I don't know, but he can play small forward, especially if you're going to, you know, compare him to like a 6'10 Paul George. He would be interesting in Memphis to me too.
I like that fit too. I think if you could play him, if they'd use him as the four next to Gasol, you could really like get some, they haven't had that kind of spacing ever. So that would be a much needed dynamic. And I mean, again, he's a great shooting prospect. I think he needs to get more credit for that. He's really high level. A lot of people think he's like Rudy Gay type. I think he's going to be a better shooter, and we don't really know about the instincts and the defense and the passing yet. That's just kind of a work in progress.
And would you say Bagley is your number five?
Ayton is number five, I guess.
Oh, Ayton.
Yeah, I think Phoenix for them, just because, God, they need rebounding so bad. And they need somebody at the five who can actually give them big man minutes. I mean, I know they've been playing Bender there more, and he's actually been good offensively as far as they're actually utilizing his creation, his playmaking at the top of the key. He's an excellent passer. But just looking long term, I mean, they're so bad on the defensive glass. Ayton is such a monster rebounder. I don't know if they have Bender. In theory, could help cover for some of Ayton's rim protection issues. He's not the most instinctual defender. He's defended the rim better, and when he's involved in the play, he moves really well in space. So I think he's going to be overall a plus defensive player. I don't think he's going to be a dynamite defensive player like an anchor type. But the Suns stand out to me more than any of the other top level teams as far as what they specifically need. So that would be probably my pick there.
Yeah, I would probably like him there more if he. I guess none of their bigs were polished defensively though. It just because you've already taken the flyers on Chris and Bender, who haven't given you anything defensively, and now you're going with Ayton. Even if you think he's going to be a plus defender at some point, how long does it take for him to develop into one? Yep. He would be kind of interesting. You've already made this comparison, basically, but him and Markkanen in Chicago would be super interesting if that opportunity presents itself. Although I guess the same defensive issues kind of plague you there, but Fred Hoiberg coaching those two bigs would be super fun.
That's a great point. I like that fit too, but for the same reasons. it's tough with him if you don't fully believe in the rim protection, the anchoring ability. I just know he's going to rebound and he's going to outleap people. He's bigger, and for the teams in the top five-ish, he's going to go top two. I would be surprised if he doesn't go number one, honestly. And for the teams drafting that range, I think you could even make a case for Dallas, like in a pick and roll with Dennis Smith. Like, you can't switch that with Ayton. He's just too good on the interior. He's too big. So that would just open up a lot of opportunities there too. You could even make a case for that, even though they don't have the defensive infrastructure either.
Who do you got at number six?
Right now I have Mo Bamba. It's really close with him and Marvin Bagley, 6'7". Bamba's one of the toughest fits. I did that pod with Vecini. I ended up with Memphis at 7, and I took Bamba there, and I think that's the worst-case scenario. Honestly, just playing behind Marcus Gasol on a team that needs production right now or wants that, I think it's going to take him a couple years to really get his legs under him. He needs to add girth in his lower body, solidify his frame. So when you look at a team that you know is far away and just needs an upside shot, I mean, what team stands out for you as far as in that predicament? What team stands out as far as, like, we have multiple years, we're going to build long-term, we can invest a lot of capital in this guy and a lot of time?
I think Chicago would be one. I guess that's kind of tricky just because if you assume they're going to resign Zach LaVine this summer. It would be kind of interesting if Cleveland's the one that ends up with him, and then you're kind of entering trade negotiations with other teams for it. Is there, like, a... is Charlotte a team? Like, if you were talking about a huge, like, Kemba Walker blockbuster with them, that would have the patience for him. I don't even know. It's so, you're right. He is, like, one of the toughest ones to place. Wow, that's a good question. No, not Sacramento. Screw Sacramento. I think you could easily make the case for Dallas, depending on how gradual they're trying to make their rebuild. I don't think they're probably going to end up picking higher than he would go. Memphis would be fine if they finally decide to rebuild. That would probably, like, having Bamba there wouldn't be, that would actually be like a better fit. If you're going to move Gasol and you're going to move Mike Conley, I don't know what you're going to do with Chandler Parsons. No one's trading for him. Then you could use him as a building block. Chicago for me kind of, I think, would stand out more, or Dallas. Dallas is just, I guess you could plug, Dallas has been on the search for these bigs forever. So maybe they'd be more willing to take some risks. They've tried to do it in free agency a bunch of times. So those would be the two teams that I think stand out more than anyone else.
Yeah, I think I'm inclined to agree with you. I mean, the Kings can use rim protection, but we've seen how they develop bigs. I just can't do it to Bamba. I think his upside is too high to go there. And then you have, I think, Dallas, Chicago, both those teams make sense conceptually. I like Bamba's fit as an anchor. If you're going to have LaVine, if you're going to have Markkanen, who knows what you're going to have, a small forward or whatnot, you're going to need someone who can really protect the rim at a high level. So he makes a lot of conceptual sense there.
And number seven, we're getting near the end.
Marvin Bagley. So this one's kind of easy because I think Bagley is the most fit-dependent player in the draft. So there's definitely two teams that stand out in the top 10. Memphis is one. I think Bagley's going to be able to produce from day one. You can play him in pick and roll with Conley, and you have the unicorn type with Gasol spacing the floor, even though you probably want to involve Gasol in the screen more than Bagley just for that gravity he creates as a shooter. But I do think that he fits what they want to do. Gives them a much-needed athleticism injection as a pick-and-roll kind of play finisher. You have to utilize him as a play finisher. I think he's more of a five in the Amari role, and you kind of have to build around him. But there are certain predicaments that allow for, you know, more conducive roster fit. The clear one for me is the Knicks. If they end up with a top-four pick, he would make so much sense next to Porzingis. Bagley can defend the perimeter better than Porzingis. He's still a work in progress there, but I like having Porzingis behind him. And then offensively, for the same dynamic, you can have Porzingis kind of spacing the floor some for Bagley, who can play in pick and roll. When Porzingis is in pick and roll, Bagley can be in the dunker spot. There's just more spacing there. So those two teams are the clear ones that stand out to me.
The Knicks, I feel like I'm going to go with you on them because I want a reason for them to shift Kristaps Porzingis to center full time. And I don't, you're not going to draft Bagley and say, hey, he's going to be a three. Although I've been, like, as still kind of like a Knicks fan implant, although my fandom has waned over the years since covering the league, I would love to see them get Mikal Bridges. That's been the guy that, since they've been hopelessly mediocre this season, that I've wanted them to sort of land. Who do you have for number 10? Number 8 and final for this question for you.
You just mentioned him, Mikal Bridges, who fits on literally every team because that's what he is as a player, like that 3-and-D kind of high instincts wing. He can shoot a little bit off motion this year, more confident, a little bit off the bounce, but mostly you're looking at him as like a peak kind of Shane Battier type. Maybe he fits everywhere. So, I mean, you take your pick. You can go, I took him for the Knicks yesterday when I did that mock drafts. I thought that his fit
Thank
next to...
Thank you so much.
I thought his fit next to Ntilikina and Porzingis, like aligning that kind of defensive core would be pretty special. If you have Ntilikina and him defending on the wings, they're both a little light, but I think they both play bigger than their size. That's one thing Ntilikina has really impressed me with this year. He'll walk bigger guys out of the lane like Julius Randle. So with Mikhail, I believe in the shooting. So you could really, you could argue him for Memphis. I mean, they've needed a wing like that forever. I think at five, you're not taking Mikhail Bridges. He probably goes, you know, after pick 10. I wouldn't expect him to go where I have him ranked. I think he'll probably be devalued a little bit just based on his age and his upside. But you can make a case. I mean, he could be utilized on the Cavs next to LeBron. Even the Magic could use him. Again, he's just someone who's super easy to fit on basically any roster because he's kind of the ideal combination of what the modern game is coming, is looking for.
He would, yes, you're probably right there. I would love to see, especially if he's going to go after 10 or after, like, if he's going to go outside the top eight, you start talking about teams
Philly.
Like, yeah, Philly. I was about to say Philly. They need yep. wings bad. Even Utah would be incredibly interesting just to have. I mean, like, look what they've done with Donovan Mitchell. Even Royce O'Neal has done some things there. Now you have Jay Crowder. You have Joe Ingles. If you had him, talk about some defensive switchability. That would be fun to watch.
And I think you hit the nail on the head with the Philly one especially. That's the pick that everybody's been looking at all year with the Lakers pick. Mikhail's always been the guy in that range that makes the most sense. They just desperately need guys who can guard smaller players, can be versatile on the defensive end, add floor spacing around their primaries. He's definitely the guy. If he's there at 11 and they don't take him, I'd be pretty stunned.
Are they the type of team, if they just end up, even with the Lakers trying to win games, if they kind of end up at 8 or 7, do you think they have like the stones to kind of roll the dice on him there, or is that too high?
That's a really great question. It's so hard to know because some of the other upside guys in that range, like some guys really like Wendell Carter. I'm a big Wendell Carter fan. It's hard to justify him on the Sixers. So they're going to pass up on some of the bigs because they're not going to take a big in the top 10, in my opinion. There's no way you can do that when you have Embiid, even with the injury history. You have to roll the dice on a position of value and position of need, more importantly. So I think that they might end up trying to trade back in that scenario. Maybe the Clippers try to trade up. They have two picks in the lottery. They wouldn't trade both, of course, but maybe they try to make a move and they look to maybe better their draft positional value, picking up an additional pick. I don't know if they'd take him 8 or 9, honestly. That seems like maybe a touch of a reach for them. I don't think it is at all. If I was the Sixers, Mikhail would be in my top 5 in this class. I just think he does exactly what they need.
Yeah, I think he would be a fantastic fit there. We'll have to see how that pans out. I was very interested. I loved your fits because they were like, I don't want to use the word against the grain to imply that they were just hot takey, but they were super interesting and they weren't necessarily all convention everything. So thank you for doing that on the fly. That was not an easy one to answer.
No, it's all good. This is what I think about on a daily basis. So it's just conveying that information over podcast form.
Well, Cole, thank you again for coming on. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm sure I'll be pestering you again in the future to come on. If you guys want to follow Cole, and you absolutely should, he is at Cole Zewicker. That's ColeZewicker. Find his work at The Stepien. He is a scout for Net Scouts. He's a contributor to The Step Back. And follow him on Twitter again because he has great salary cap analysis. He's a CBA aficionado. That's just a fantastic follow. If you're following me or Andy and not him, I don't really know what you're doing with your life. If you do want to follow me, however, I am at Dan Favale. That's Favale. You can follow Andy at Andrew D. Bailey, spelled as it sounds. Follow our host, MBA Math, at MBA_Math. You can find Hardwood Knox at Hardwood Knox. I forgot to bump this at the beginning of the podcast, but please, your subscriptions, reviews, and ratings on iTunes mean the world to us. So if you haven't, take the 10 to 15 seconds out of your day. Please give us a starred review, 5-star preferably, but I don't want to tell you guys what to do. Subscribe and also an actual review. That helps. You know, give us feedback. We'd like to know that you're listening and taking things in. Since Andy is not here, I only have to give one shout out, and that is the ceremonial shout out to the one, the only, the GOAT, Kyle Anderson. Until next time.